And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Chapel Hill native Ben Fountain has been richly honored for his, and widely respected in the writing community, particularly for his stories, short stories, particularly those assembled in the book Brief Encounters with Che Guevara, which was sort of the title short story of that volume, won multiple awards. We got him to visit with us about his first novel, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. And for a first novelist, Ben Fountain, you sure are getting a lot of attention.
Well, it's nice. Thank you for having me on the show, DG.
It's a treat for us in Chapel Hill to have you back in town. It must be mixture of a whole bunch of mixture of feelings. First of all, you know, we're in the week in which the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Dallas papers have all given very supportive reviews of your work, and not ever having published a novel before, not knowing what the critics were doing, but knowing that because of your reputation, we're lining up to take a look at it. You got to feel pretty good.
Well, it's
Are you like every other author? Well, they weren't good enough.
No, all I can ask of reviewers is that they read the book with an open mind and just pay some attention to it and beyond that, call it like you see it. And so, it's really nice and gratifying that they seem to be finding a lot of good things in the book. So, but you know, as opposed to joy, it's mostly a sense of relief that they aren't pounding it. So, I have to say, relief is maybe, you know, it's 48% joy and 52% relief.
Yeah, I love that. Well, one of the things that's always interesting when for an author is that people get things out of the book that the author didn't, you know, that wasn't the principal thing that the author was putting in the book. You know, that readers are privileged to have their own experience based on what the author wrote. And the same thing with reviewers. Reviewers may dwell on things or find things important in the book that the author might be surprised. Janet Maslin, one of the toughest New York Times reviewers in review this week in the New York Times, it seemed to me, got it in the sense that as I read her review, I said, I believe Ben Fountain's going to be pleased that she got the basic feeling, message, the conflicts, and was able to describe them in, I guess, a 800-word or 800 or 1,000-word review. So that was my feeling, but now, how about you? When you read it, did you feel like she got it?
Oh yeah, yeah. She got the anger in it, and I hope it was controlled anger, but anger nonetheless. I mean, my sense, a big part of what informed the writing of the book was a sense of profound injustice and immorality that, you know, drove these wars, and so I wanted that to come through, and I used a combination of ways to hopefully have that come through, and part of it was, you know, really blowing out the language, making it kind of baroque and high wire, and this combination of high and low, and also, you know, the mockery and the humor. But, you know, I wanted the anger to come through, and I think she very much picked up on that.
When you're talking, you're on the road now giving reading and giving talks about the book. How do you open up your talks to explain to an audience that may not have yet read the book? What do you tell them?
Well, you know, the book came out of this sense that that was growing on me in 2004, 2005, 2006, that I didn't have a clue about the United States, this country where I was born and grew up. I didn't understand it. And that was brought home to me by the fact that I couldn't understand how these wars came about without more protest and objection and questioning on the part of the power structure and just the general population. And I had a friend visiting me from Haiti at one point in 2004-2005, and he's an ophthalmologist. He's one of the smartest people I've ever known, and he was mystified. He said, "Ben, I think the United States has really degenerated morally. I mean, all of you should be out in the streets protesting this war. It's everybody around the world, realizes that this war was undertaken under false pretenses. And in Vietnam, y'all were protesting. Why aren't you out in the streets now?" So, the book came out of this sense of, yes, that's a good question. Why aren't we? How did it come to be? And maybe the book is, that's me trying to understand America, the collective psychology, if you will.
Well, I want to shift gears, but come back later on to the feelings of your feelings of worry about the country and how the book helps to express or reflect those feelings. But I have to tell you, I also have to worry about the story itself. I mean, it was kind of like, people read Gulliver's Travels and they just love the story and they don't understand the political situation that was behind the writing of the book. And I'm kind of a naive reader, so I love the story of these eight soldiers who are really, they're young and naive in some respects. In other ways, they're battle-tested and far beyond anything I will ever be in terms of understanding the horrors of war and the importance of being faithful to your and supportive of the people in your unit.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have them thrown into the halftime of the Dallas Cowboy, Chicago football game, and all of the pageantry is exploding. So you have one reader who was more engaged with this, who thinks that even if you don't catch up on your anger and the kinds of things you were trying to present as a part of the book. Man, what a story. So tell us a little bit about the story.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that you had that reaction because, to me, I want stories that take you somewhere. I'm a maximalist as opposed to a minimalist. I want things to happen in stories and novels, and I want them to show me something that I don't know already and take me on a trip while they're doing it. I just tried to write the kind of novel that I like to read.
Well, now tell us the story. Tell us this. I mean, you don't have to give away, but just tell us the scene. I mean, you set this scene so well in your book. So if you were sitting around the campfire and somebody said, "Tell us about these boys on Thanksgiving, these soldiers on Thanksgiving Day." And you can't tell the whole story, but set it up for us.
Let's see. Well, there was a squad of 10 soldiers. They were in a fierce battle in Iraq. One was grievously wounded. Another was killed. So there were 8 survivors. A Fox News crew caught the engagement on film, and the film went viral in the American culture. And so the Bush administration has brought the 8 surviving members of Bravo, and they're called Bravo, back to the United States for a 2-week victory tour to pump up support for the war. And so the Bravos have been jetted all over the country, appearing at malls and convention centers and auditoriums to rally support for the war. The book takes place on the very last day of their victory tour. They are the guest of honor at a Dallas Cowboys football game, which is the Thanksgiving Day game. And as soon as this event is over, they go back to Fort Hood, and they'll go straight back to Iraq and right back into combat. So the book follows them throughout the course of their day at Texas Stadium, where they have a press conference, they meet billionaires, they're the guests of honor in the owner's suite, they have encounters with cheerleaders and football players and grateful citizens, so anyway, The book follows them throughout the course of the day.
It's all compacted in one day. That what helped me identify with the situation, although Keenan Stadium is not anywhere near as big and complex as Texas Stadium, which although it's, as you describe it, it's aging, it still is a, you know, it's a monster. It's a,
yeah.
It's got all kinds of, it's a city within a, you know, it's a city in addition to being a sports arena with all sorts of class divisions and things going on football day. And you describe some of these things. One of the things that is fun for, particularly for folks who've never been in the owner's suite of a pro football team's owner, the trip into the suite to see how the, you know, we see, I hear what we see sometimes on television football games. We see the owners watching the game from their suites.
Right.
But there's a whole lot more going on than just sitting watching. They're back there dealing with their rich friends and selling things and doing things. And you take us there.
Well, yeah, I do. And I have to say, I've never been in an owner's suite.
Well, how did you do it? It seemed pretty realistic to me. I've been in the Tar Heels Chancellor's box, and it's pretty nice up there, but nothing like the way you described the owner's suite.
Well, this is old Texas Stadium where the Cowboys played from, I don't know, 1971 until 2008 or 9, and it's been demolished. But so this isn't
the current stadium.
Fancy new Cowboys stadium where they play now. The Texas Stadium, you know, it was an aging facility by the time I'm writing about, and the Cowboys were really kind of letting it go. It wasn't being well maintained, and so it had the atmosphere of, you know, a 1970s Holiday Inn that hasn't been refurbished, and so there's a shabbiness to it. The owner's suite is a step or two above that. But the Bravos come in expecting, you know, swank luxury, maybe on the order of Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion out in Los Angeles. And what they get instead is kind of like the reception room of a, you know, second rate convention center. But still, you know, everyone there is wealthy and friendly and gregarious and successful, and there's lots of food and there's an open bar, so it's not bad, especially for, you know, a bunch of 19 and 20 year old soldiers. But as far as, you know, describing that scene and getting into it, you know, I did all the research I could. There wasn't a whole lot on you know, what goes on in the owner's suite at the owner's suite at Texas Stadium, but. And then, you know, I just tried to imagine my way into that world and use my own experience and the little bit of research I was able to find to try to make it come alive.
Well, you did a great job as far as this reader is concerned. I enjoyed my trip to the Texas Stadium and the owner's suite particularly. We're visiting with Ben Fountain. We're talking to him about his debut novel, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, and he and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Chapel Hill native Ben Fountain, talking about his debut novel, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. It's a long halftime walk that knocked me off my feet. It's set... in one afternoon on Thanksgiving Day at Old Texas Stadium, where the Dallas Cowboys are playing the Thanksgiving Day pageant football game against the Chicago Bears. And Ben Fountain has placed in this context eight Iraq war. I don't want to call them veterans exactly. They're fighting in Iraq, and they've been given 2 weeks to come and be feted by the country as a result of their heroic firefight being recorded by Fox News, and then I guess being put on YouTube, and everybody in the country seeing it. And so these soldiers are heroes. But Ben Fountain, they're complex. The reactions that the soldiers have to being placed in the center of this pageant where they're honored, their feelings are complex and varied, as you describe them.
Yeah. You know, they are the oldest soldier in the squad is 24 years old. And the youngest, Billy Lynn, the title character, he's 19 years old. And so in terms of years, you know, they're pretty youthful. But as one of them, as Billy thinks at one point in the book, maybe combat ages you in dog years and ages you physically. And
yeah, explain that. Explain, I mean, that was a great that if they're dogs, they're old men.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the quality of the experience they've had. But they see the world, I mean, they see the world, you know, perhaps more clearly than their countrymen who haven't been fighting over in Iraq. They're very acutely aware of the artificiality of certain situations, of, you know, just how deep a lot of the words of praise and appreciation go, which often is not very deep. And so these kids, you know, kids though they be, they're very savvy and very wise to the ways of the world.
Your novel reminds us that the attitude of the American people towards their fighting servicemen and women is different in connection with the Iraq and the Gulf and the Iraq and Afghanistan wars than it was in Vietnam. Even those people who disagree with the war seem to honor and pay tribute to the servicemen and women.
And right. Well,
why is that?
No one ever comes out and criticizes the war or these soldiers. And at one point, Billy, he's thinking to himself and he reflects that no one has called him baby killer. And he almost wishes that they would, you know, so that there would be some acknowledgement that, I mean, literally babies have been killed, that war is destruction and bloodshed and pain and suffering and tragedy. And he almost wishes that someone would show anger and object to the war because that's part of his full experience of it, and he wants an acknowledgement of that.
Billy Lynn and his colleagues understand better than some of us who are not there that any war, that the consequences of any war, even a war that has great ideals and aspirations, that the unintended consequences with respect to the disruption of regular ongoing life is horrible, and that when you're fighting and you see something move and you shoot at it, you can't always guarantee that it's going to be the enemy that gets hit.
Right. It's, you know, there's been a lot of groundbreaking research in the last, say, decade, and, you know, obviously most of it is focused on, you know, these particular wars, Afghanistan and Iraq. And the emotional and psychological cost of killing, and that is when you're the person who's doing the killing, it's tremendous. And there are such things as necessary wars. I mean, the world is a difficult place. There are a lot of aggressive interest out there. And there are such things as necessary wars, but war should be undertaken as the ultimate last resort. If for no other reason that you cannot put these young men and you can't ask these young men and women to make the sacrifices that they do without it being absolutely necessary. I mean, they put themselves in a position where they're willing to die for their country. That's a soldier's job. That's really, you know, the oath they take implies that. And so it's on us as a country not to betray the trust they've put in us. We've got to be, you know, extremely careful about what we ask these young men and women to do.
We're visiting with Ben Fountain. Ben is a Chapel Hill native. He's the author of a brand new book, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, and he and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Ben Fountain is my guest. Ben, you were born in Chapel. Were you born in Chapel Hill, near Chapel Hill?
Yeah, I was born on the campus. I was born, I don't know if they still call it Memorial Hospital, but the hospital there on campus. Yeah. So I am actually a Tar Heel born.
Tar Heel born. And your family's, somebody told me that y'all were living in Chapel Hill, down at the bottom of the hill, Raleigh Road.
Our first home was graduate student housing. My dad was getting his PhD, and it was over there by the old Forest Theater. And where we lived is now a parking lot.
Oh, come on.
No, it's that parking lot over there by the Forest Theater. And then we moved to some apartments at Glen Lennox.
Wow.
And those are some of my earliest memories.
Those are nice places. The red brick
shopping center there, at Glen Lennox, and we moved away when I was 3 or 4 years old. We moved to Elizabeth City.
Well, some people remember your parents, and they're still here in North Carolina,
right? Yeah, my parents live in Cary now. My dad had both my parents had long, very productive careers in education, and so my parents and all three of my sisters are still in North Carolina.
Well, I mean, when you were back, are you drawn back to North Carolina? Or are you a confirmed Texan now?
I've been in Texas 29 years. Next year we'll make 30, and frankly, I'm ready to come back. I've always felt a very strong visceral pull toward North Carolina, and more and more, I'm kind of aching to come back. So I married a Dallas girl. Maybe one of these days I can convince her to come back to North Carolina with me. But
well, you all have two. You got Texas children who are not going to be drawn back to North Carolina.
One lives in Dallas, but the other is in New York. So I think they'll be okay with wherever we end up.
Well, what about your education at growing up in North Carolina and at Carolina? You started out to be a lawyer, so were you focused on your legal education when you were an undergraduate at Chapel Hill, or were you influenced by some of the great writing and literature teachers here at Carolina?
No, I kind of backed into the law. I formed this notion at the age of around 16 or 17 that I might want to write, and when I got to Carolina, I was an English major, and my sophomore year, I talked my way into Doris Betts' honors fiction writing class. Mm. I wasn't in the honors program, so I cornered her outside of drop ad and said, I would really like to be in your course. And I had done very little writing up until then, and Doris Betts, what a great lady, a great writer, a great teacher, and just big-hearted, very wise woman. And so she said, well, we've got too many in the class right now. Some people are going to have to drop, but why don't you come on to the first class? And the syllabus in that class was so outrageously daunting that 3 or 4 people dropped right away. So I was in. But she was the one who, she got me going. She gave me not just the nuts and bolts, but she was great about the big picture, the writing life and the pros of it and the cons of it. And then my junior year, I took Marianne Ginger.
Oh, wow.
Also a tremendous teacher. And she took me to the next step. So,
what do you mean the next step? What does that mean?
You know, just developing as a writer, getting stronger, and learning more. And I mean, in Doris Beth's class, we had to write and revise one short story. I mean, we were doing lots of writing exercises, but in Marianne's class, she required three stories. And so you had to become more workmanlike in your approach. You couldn't wait for inspiration to come down from the mountain. You had to call it down from the mountain. She, you know, just a wonderful teacher, and she's still over there at Chapel Hill working hard.
Yeah, she's still an enthusiastic and seems to be so totally supportive in terms of working with people with different interest and with, you know, different levels of talent at the stage of being a college student.
Right. And they've the writing program at UNC, it just gets stronger and stronger. Great faculty, and they work together extremely well. And the program they've set up where, you know, they consciously take you from one step to the next, so that if this is the work you're concentrating on when you're in college, by the time you graduate, you've really got some serious chops as a writer.
Well, but then, but notwithstanding this great support and education that you got in writing at Carolina, you went over, you sold out in two ways. You went to Duke, and then you went to law school and gave up the writing career. Well, what happened? Did the devil get into your life?
That's kind of a harsh way to put it, DG. Along about my junior, senior year, I decided I wanted something, really rigorous and that would test me in a different kind of way. And anytime you're around writing and writers, there's an awful lot of posing that goes on. Mm-hmm. And I wanted something that would be just a total meritocracy and no BS about it. And so, I think I was scared of writing. I saw that, you know, I saw graduation looming, and I thought, well, I want to write, but it would be too much like casting yourself off into limbo just to graduate and then say, well, I'm going to write. And so the idea of writing scared me, and so law school was a way to avoid it. And also I wanted the experience. I wanted to learn something about how the world works, why the way things are the way they are, and it seemed like law was one way I could do that.
Well, when I was in law school, I found out that that my colleagues who had good writing experience, either as journalists, you know, working for newspapers, or that they were disciplined writers, they had a real edge in terms of the way law school was taught, and that you were graded primarily on how well you could do on a final exam.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The law is words. It's nothing if not words. And what's in all those law books? Words. And so someone who has skill at writing and reading and, you know, close reading, they definitely have an advantage.
There was another piece of it, and I'd be interested to see if you agree with me about this, but there was also a notion that the people who wrote knew how to finish. Some of the rest of us who learned to wrestle with the hard problems in the law and the conflicts and the ambiguity and all of those things, we were stumped by that when it came to writing it down and couldn't get to the end. Whereas people who had written short stories or had written newspaper articles knew that at some point you had to finish. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to come to a conclusion, even if you weren't absolutely sure about it. You had to wrestle with this and come up with your best, and that they would finish and have something that made sense, while some of the rest of us, I'm talking about me, time ran out before I'd really gotten there. And so I was envious of those people that had writing training and set about to try to make up for that a little bit.
Finishing is hard. You bring up a good point. And I come across a lot of aspiring writers, and they say, well, I have a lot of stories that I've started, but I can't finish anything. And I think that's part of being a pro, and I mean that in the best sense, somebody who's learned the nuts and bolts and is comfortable, you know, just with the the grind of getting it out. If you have a lot of experience in writing, you know you have to finish. And so even when you don't know how it's supposed to finish, you go ahead and start making stabs at it. Because really, often, that's the only way you're going to figure out how to finish, is by doing it.
Well, this brings back to my mind this wonderful, what I think is a wonderful tribute to you, but written by Malcolm Gladwell a few years ago about late bloomers, late blooming geniuses, in which, to me it would be a great compliment. It might be an ambiguous compliment that he compared you to Cézanne, who was a painter who is so much appreciated now, but had to really work. He didn't bloom in the first time he picked up the paintbrush. Mm-mm. Just a struggle and a struggle. And so Malcolm Gladwell's point, I think, and you must have read this a few times, so you correct me, was that you, like Cézanne, didn't hit a home run the first time you started writing, but that through struggle and experimentation and a willingness to go out and search, your writing, I think he said, is richer and deeper maybe than the instant successes. Primarily that when you were stuck in terms of writing, instead of throwing up your hands and you went out and found things, you went to Haiti. Not only hundreds of times, but many times over and over and over again, and found the richness and the experience that, that led to, portions of this great story about the Che Guevara, multiple short stories, but also other stories set in Haiti that if you'd been an instant success as a writer, you would have never had those experiences. So anyway, I'm talking, but I mean, what do you think about what I said about Malcolm Gladwell's story about you?
I think nobody sets out to be a late bloomer. I think if we all had our preference, we would all have our success early, and we would be able to bask in the admiration and affection of our family and friends and the world in general. And so nobody sets out to have 20 years of failure, and I had 15, 16 years of pretty rank failure. And but what I was doing, going to Haiti and otherwise sitting down at the desk and doing my work, I was living my life, and there was no grand plan except to try to figure out how to write something that's hopefully, genuine and worthwhile. And, I'm no genius. And, to the extent that I have any spark of genius in me, maybe it's just hard-headedness. I mean, this willingness and desire to go back to the desk every day and try to find the right words to match up with the experience that I'm trying to convey.
We're visiting with Ben Fountain. We're doing it in the context of the launch of his first novel, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which is getting incredibly positive attention, including this week reviews in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times, which have been very, very strong. When we come back, I want to talk some more with Ben Fountain about his book.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Ben Fountain. We're talking with him about writing and about life in the United States, as reflected in his novel, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which I think it's taken the critics by storm, and I think will be taking the country by storm. So thanks for giving us kind of a first opportunity to talk to you about it. Ben, there's so many great scenes that I want to talk about. I want to talk about the love scene with this Dallas Cowboy cheerleader that even this old man got aroused by the description of the young people in love again. But something that was, more engaging to me maybe than anything was the trip that one of the soldiers got to take into the Dallas Cowboy the locker room might not be the right, but in the equipment room, there in Texas Stadium, where all of this equipment to support the multiple occasions in which the Dallas Cowboys might be on the playing field, rain, snow, sleet, storm, you know, dry weather, everything. Tell us, put us in the eyes of the, or in the shoes of the soldier who gets the inside look at the equipment room.
Right. Well, Billy, the title character, is they've been taken down to the Dallas Cowboys locker room before the game to meet the players and get autographs, and Billy's kind of standing around, and one of the equipment managers asks him, would Billy like a tour of the equipment room? And so Billy says sure, and so this older gentleman takes him into the equipment room, and Billy is staggered by the sheer volume of material it takes to support a football team. And, I mean, just, you know, they go through 3,000 pairs of shoes a season.
Wow.
And you know, things as mundane as chewing gum. I mean, he sees boxes of chewing gum stacked up to the ceiling and stacks of shoulder pads like bones in you know, some Roman catacomb. And just material. You know, material wealth, material goods. And I wasn't sure where this scene was going when I was writing it. All I knew is that I just wanted to get into the sheer abundance and industrial might, manufacturing might, that goes into the game of football. And could any other country in the world, could any other civilization in the history of the world have fielded, you know, such a product-intensive sport? And does that say something about America and this culture? And it just seemed to me there's something there, and maybe what I was feeling was this sense of tremendous imbalance that so much is going to support this sport and these players. I mean, are things out of joint? And so that's where I found myself going in this scene, and I mean, I didn't want to overplay my hand, but there did seem to be, you know, when I do see football teams on the field, college, you know, big-time college or pro, if you look along the sidelines at the sheer volumes of stuff, I don't know, it makes you wonder.
Well, you know, it struck me as this is war. This is analogous to Billy Lynn in Iraq and with having the support of a whole supply chain, so that it's there's a whole lot more to the game than just what it used to be, which was 11 players on each side out on the field, and they each had a pair of shoes that they'd had for 5 or 10 years, and they could put all of their equipment in a little a locker in the locker room.
Right.
But now it's just a whole monstrous supply thing to be sure that every edge is gained.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I still haven't gotten my head around exactly where I'm going in that scene, and obviously it's too late to do any revisions at this point. But I don't know. It seems to me when the emphasis is so much on the material, so much on having the most up-to-date, you know, as you say, getting that final little edge in terms of material advantage, I don't know. I distrust that.
Yeah.
When you say that.
Well, another thing that just grabbed me about this scene was, here's poor young Billy Lynn, and he's really just got one request. He's in the middle of this, you know, awesome temple of wealth and availability of food, of everything that you need, you can get. But Billy's got a headache, and all he wants is an aspirin or Advil. And everybody, nobody remembers to get him one. And so his head, all the way through this wonderful Thanksgiving Day, his head throbbing. And then he gets in the supply room, and then he sees these stacks of pain-killing medicine. And so he asked the supply guy, well, could I just have one? You know, one. He said, oh, no, can't do that. I've got to fill out a chart. I've got to keep records of everything that we give away. And, you know, I'm not allowed to give anything to you, not even an aspirin, not even an Advil. I mean, when you woke up at night and developed that scene, you must have just smiled because it's so powerful.
Well, yeah, poor Billy. I mean, he's he can't get what he needs. I mean, he's here in the heart of American abundance and wealth, and he can't get what he needs. And one of those things that he needs some painkiller for his hangover headache. And so he's constantly frustrated throughout the day. And I mean, yes, the equipment manager would love to give him, you know, a couple of aspirin, but he can't because of liability issues and inventory control and you know, the sheer bureaucracy of professional sports. He can't give, you know, this United States soldier Silver Star decorated. He can't give him two aspirin.
Can't give him an aspirin. Well, I hate to end it, although this is, I promise you, this is an image that will remain with me the rest of my life. And it's not the only one in your wonderful book, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. Ben Fountain, thanks for the book and all the effort that it took to put it together. Congratulations on
the
success.
Thank you, DG, and thanks for the great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
And thanks all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.